Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
All right, let's open the vault to some fundamental legal concepts today. Have you ever found yourself watching, say, a crime drama or maybe a news report, and you just get this nagging feeling that you don't quite grasp the precise limits of police authority? Or maybe what your own rights truly are when you interact with law enforcement. It's easy to feel like you're trying to wade through, you know, a dense legal textbook full of jargon and confusing scenarios. Well, today's deep dive is designed to cut through all that complexity. We're taking a close look at several foundational amendments of the U.S. Constitution, specifically the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th, and we'll also weave in related Texas laws as well. Our focus will be on absolutely crucial areas like search and seizure, arrest powers, and the comprehensive protections afforded to anyone accused of an offense. Our mission really is to take what often appears as, well, overwhelming legal material and break it down. We want to provide you with a clear instructional understanding of these critical concepts. Think of it as a much-needed user manual for your constitutional protections and the powers that apply to law enforcement in the real world.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here is that these aren't just, you know, abstract legal texts or high-minded ideals reserved for courtrooms. These amendments and statutes are the bedrock of the everyday interactions you might have. They literally define the boundaries between individual liberty and government authority. Understanding them empowers you. It really does. It provides clarity on what is and isn't permissible. It helps you navigate situations with confidence, knowing your rights, and the limits of state power.
That's a great point. And you mentioned the source material is interesting for this one.
Yes, exactly. What makes this deep dive particularly unique is the source material we're drawing from today. It's actually a law enforcement training handout. So this means we're going to be looking at the exact kind of detail officers themselves are taught, which offers, I think, an unparalleled behind-the-curtain perspective into their framework of understanding.
Okay, so we're getting the inside scoop, basically.
Kind of, yeah.
Right.
And we'll build this knowledge block by block, starting with the very basics of the Fourth Amendment and then progressively moving through the nuances.
The Fourth Amendment, your shield against unreasonable intrusion.
Okay, let's dive straight into the Fourth Amendment then. It kicks off with this incredibly powerful statement. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Now, those terms, persons, houses, papers, and effects, they sound broad, but what are the crucial nuances listeners should really grasp about what's protected here?
That's a great question, because while they sound straightforward, their legal definitions are actually quite encompassing. When the amendment refers to persons, it's not just your physical body. It extends to anything directly on you, like your clothing or what you're carrying in your pockets. Houses isn't limited to a detached home. It broadly includes any place where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So that could be an apartment, a hotel room, maybe even a tent.
So privacy is the key concept for houses.
Yeah. Exactly. A reasonable expectation of privacy. Then you have papers, which covers your documents, letters, even digital files these days. Essentially, anything that conveys information and holds personal significance. And finally, effects is sort of a comprehensive catch-all for your personal belongings. Like your car, your phone, your backpack, any other private property. The design here is intentionally broad, aiming to safeguard your personal spaces and possessions from, well, arbitrary government intrusion.
And the word that really jumps out, the one that sets the standard, is unreasonable. This isn't just legal jargon, is it? It feels like the real battleground.
Oh, absolutely. That's the crux of it. It's where virtually every challenge to police action is fought. It's not usually about if they searched, but how and why they believed it was justified. was it reasonable under the circumstances? That unreasonable standard is what the law constantly applies and interprets through, you know, countless different scenarios.
Okay, so unreasonable is the standard. Now, you mentioned seizures as well. What exactly counts as a seizure? Is it just being arrested?
No, and that's a critical piece that often surprises people. Seizure is defined much more broadly under the Fourth Amendment, a landmark case. Tennessee v. Garner from 1985 made it unequivocally clear. Police use of deadly force is considered a seizure under the Fourth Amendment.
Oh, okay. Deadly force is a seizure.
Yes. And that means when an officer uses deadly force, that action must meet the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness standard. And it doesn't stop there. This principle extends to all police uses of force. Whether it's a simple touch that restricts your movement, putting on handcuffs, or more significant physical restraint, every instance of police force is technically a seizure in the eyes of the Fourth Amendment.
So any use of force has to be reasonable.
Precisely. It places this crucial constitutional lens on virtually every physical interaction between law enforcement and the public. It requires that each act of force, no matter how minor or significant, be objectively reasonable, given the circumstances. It's a fundamental check on government power.
Okay, so if unreasonable searches and seizures are prohibited, how does the law then give police the green light to search or seize? Warrants, right?
Yeah, exactly. Warrants are the primary mechanism. And the Fourth Amendment meticulously details how these powerful documents are issued. It states, "And no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized."
Let's unpack those elements. Probable cause sounds important.
It's essential. It's the foundational legal standard for any valid warrant. We're going to dive into probable cause in much greater detail in a bit because it really dictates so much of what officers can and cannot do.
Okay. And supported by oath or affirmation? What does that mean practically?
It means the information provided to the judge or magistrate, the basis for the warrant, must be sworn to under penalty of perjury. Usually this takes the form of a written affidavit sworn by the officer. It adds a critical layer of accountability.
Got it. And the last part, particularly describing, what's the significance there?
This is incredibly important. Warrants must particularly describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. This is a direct prohibition against what are called general warrants, those broad, open-ended authorizations that historically allowed authorities to just rummage through anything and everything. Mm. This requirement ensures that law enforcement can't go on, you know, fishing expeditions. The warrant must specify precisely where they can search and exactly what or who they are authorized to seize. It limits the scope only to what is absolutely necessary based on the probable cause presented.
So no blank checks for searching?
Essentially, yes.
Sure.
It has to be targeted. Now, connecting this to the bigger picture, these protections aren't just in one federal document. States often echo these foundational rights. For instance, the Texas Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 9, directly mirrors these federal protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. It says the people shall be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and possessions from all unreasonable seizures or searches.
So Texas law reinforces this too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's further reinforced by state statutes, like the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure Article 1.06, which also emphasizes these rights. This kind of redundancy, if you will, at both the federal and state level shows the deep commitment to these principles. It means these protections are woven into multiple layers of law, providing a pretty robust shield for individual liberties against government overreach. So when we talk about constitutional rights, it's not just one document. It's really a tapestry of interconnected laws designed to safeguard you.
The sliding scale of suspicion from hunch to arrest.
Now, understanding the Fourth Amendment is one thing, but how does it actually play out in, you know, real-world police interactions? You mentioned it all comes down to different levels of proof or suspicion, like a sliding scale.
Exactly. It's not a simple on-off switch where an officer either has total authority or none. Instead, it's a continuum, a sliding scale where the amount of information an officer has dictates the actions they are legally allowed to take. This continuum ranges from the lowest level, which is called mere suspicion, then moves up through reasonable suspicion and finally reaches probable cause.
Okay, let's walk through those. What's mere suspicion? It's like not much.
It isn't, legally speaking. What's absolutely vital to grasp is that this lowest level, mere suspicion, is essentially a hunch or a feeling of intuition. Now, intuition can undoubtedly be a valuable skill for an officer, right? Helping them notice when something feels off. But legally, it's considered insufficient proof of any fact in a court of law.
So an officer can't stop me and search me based just on a hunch.
Correct. They can't detain or search you based solely on mere suspicion. However, there are a few things an officer can do. For example, they can run computer checks of license plates. That's external, non-invasive. They can also engage in surveillance, watching an individual or activity from a distance to gather additional facts and circumstances that amount to more than mere suspicion. It's about passively observing to see if more concrete information emerges without directly infringing on someone's liberty.
Okay, watching and checking plates. What about talking to someone?
Yes. Crucially, with mere suspicion, an officer can initiate a consensual contact. This is often called a police-citizen encounter. During such an encounter, and this is fundamental for you to understand, the person approached does not have to identify themselves or answer the officer's questions and are free to walk away at any time.
Really? You can just walk away?
Absolutely. You are not being detained at that point. You are free to decline to answer questions and leave. The officer's objective at this stage is very specific. It's to try and obtain articulable facts and circumstances that might eventually rise to the level of either reasonable suspicion or probable cause. Without those articulable facts, an officer operating on mere suspicion has very limited powers of interaction.
Okay, so a mere hunch isn't enough to detain you. So what's the next legal threshold then? How much more power does that give the police?
The next step up is reasonable suspicion. And this is where officers gain significantly more power. It allows them to temporarily infringe on your liberty. Reasonable suspicion is defined as articulable facts that lead a reasonable officer to believe that criminal activity may be afoot.
Articulable facts, meaning they have to be able to explain it.
Precisely. The key word here is articulable. This isn't just a hunch anymore. It means the officer must be able to clearly explain, using specific, objective facts, why they suspect criminal activity is occurring or about to occur. It has to be something concrete they can point to and describe.
And this is still less than probable cause.
Yes, it's a lower standard of proof than probable cause. But what can an officer do with reasonable suspicion? They can initiate a temporary detention, which means briefly holding someone. This is often called a Terry stop. They can also make a traffic stop if they have articulable facts that a traffic violation has occurred or is occurring. And critically, they can conduct a frisk or pat-down search.
Okay, the frisk. When can they do that?
Only under very specific circumstances. When an officer reasonably fears or believes a suspect may have a weapon. This is a limited search, strictly for officer safety to check for weapons. It's not a search for evidence of a crime, like drugs or stolen goods. It's purely about safety.
So where did this idea of a frisk come from legally?
Good question. It comes directly from a landmark Supreme Court case, Terry v. Ohio, back in 1968. Let's look at this scenario from the case. It's quite illustrative. There was an officer, very experienced, 30 years on the same beat in a commercial area during business hours. He observed two men. He watched them repeatedly peer into a store's window and then walk away. They did this about 6 times.
Okay, that does sound a bit suspicious.
Right. The officer didn't recognize them. Given his extensive experience on that beat, this behavior seemed suspicious. He formed a reasonable suspicion that criminal activity may be afoot. Specifically, he suspected they were casing the store for a robbery. So the officer stopped them. And based on his reasonable suspicion that they might be armed, given the context of a potential robbery, he patted them down. During this pat down, he felt what were obviously handguns in their pockets.
And the court said that was okay.
Yes. This case solidified the principle that even without full probable cause for an arrest, if an officer has reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is underway, they can detain a person briefly. Furthermore, if there's also reasonable suspicion that the person might have a weapon and poses a threat, the officer can conduct that limited search for weapons, the pat down for their own safety and the safety of others. It's a crucial balancing act, isn't it, between individual liberty and officer safety?
It really is. So how does this principle of reasonable suspicion apply in other contexts? Like maybe not casing a store.
Well, our source provides another fascinating example from U.S. v. Sokolow in 1989, which involved suspected drug couriers. This case really shows how a combination of articulable facts, even if each fact seems innocent on its own, can collectively create reasonable suspicion.
Okay, lay it out for us. What were the facts in Sokolow?
So law enforcement develops suspicion based on this pattern. First, the individual appeared nervous at the airport. Second, he paid $2,100 cash for 2 round-trip tickets using a big roll of $20 bills on the very day he departed. Third, it was a 20-hour flight for only a 2-day stay in Miami, which was known as a source city for drugs at the time.
a long flight for a short stay, paid in cash, starting to see a picture.
Exactly. Fourth, he traveled under a possible alias. Fifth, he always carried on his luggage, never checked bags. And sixth, he made the flight and returned in just 2 days as planned. After he was contacted based on these factors, a drug dog alerted on his bag, and sure enough, drugs were found.
So the court said all those things together were enough.
Yes. This case illustrates how a specific profile, combined with these seemingly unordinary facts, things that aren't typical for most travelers in that context, can collectively create that threshold of reasonable suspicion. Even if each fact on its own might be innocent, the accumulation and combination of these specific, observable behaviors and circumstances allowed the officers to form the necessary belief that criminal activity may be afoot, justifying a temporary detention for investigation.
That makes sense. It's the whole picture, not just one piece.
Precisely. It's the totality of the circumstances. Now, moving significantly further along the continuum, we reach a probable cause. This is a much higher bar than reasonable suspicion, and it's the standard legally required for issuing warrants, making arrests, and conducting full searches.
Okay, so define probable cause for us. How is it different?
Probable cause is defined as facts and circumstances that sufficiently justify a reasonable person to believe a crime has been committed by the actor, end quote. Notice the difference. It's not just that criminal activity may be afoot, like with reasonable suspicion. It requires a concrete belief based on specific facts that a crime has been committed, is being committed, or is about to be committed by a particular individual.
A belief, not just a suspicion.
Exactly, a justifiable belief. And when courts examine whether probable cause existed, they look at the totality of the circumstances. Think of it like putting together a puzzle. Courts don't just look at one piece of information in isolation. They consider all known information available to the officers at the precise time of the arrest or search.
At the time. So stuff they find out later doesn't count.
Crucial point, yes. Later discovered evidence, even if it confirms guilt, cannot be used retroactively to justify a past probable cause determination. The justification must exist in that moment based on the facts known then.
Got it. Now, are there different types of probable cause?
Yes. It's important to note there are two specific definitions, one for arrest and one for search, because different types of information are relevant to each. Probable cause to arrest, established way back in Brinegar v. United States, 1949, means sufficient to warrant a belief by a man of reasonable caution that a crime is being committed. The focus here is on whether a person committed an offense. Probable cause to search, derived from Carroll v. United States, 1929, means sufficient to warrant a man of reasonable caution to believe seizable property would be found in a particular place or on a particular person. Here, the focus is on where evidence might be located.
Okay, so belief a crime was committed versus belief evidence is somewhere specific.
You've got it. So, to simplify, probable cause essentially boils down to trustworthy facts and circumstances that are sufficient to a reasonable person standard to justify the belief of a crime committed by the actor or seizable property would be found in a particular place. As long as that place isn't protected by the Fourth Amendment without a warrant or exception, it's about a common sense assessment of the facts.
Common sense. That sounds a bit subjective, though.
It can feel that way, and that leads us to what's sometimes called the probable cause dilemma, as discussed in the Illinois v. Gates Supreme Court opinion. The court stated, "Perhaps the central teaching is that it is a practical, non-technical conception. In dealing with probable cause, we deal with probabilities. These are not technical. They are the factual and practical considerations of everyday life on which reasonable and prudent men, peace officers, not legal technicians, attorneys, act."
So it's about practical reality for officers, not perfect legal theory.
Exactly. That's a significant point. It means that while attorneys might analyze every legal nuance after the fact, for a peace officer on the street, probable cause is about making a common sense judgment based on the probabilities and practical realities of their job. They use their experience and training to assess whether a crime is likely occurring or evidence is likely present. It's not about perfect legal analysis in the heat of the moment. It's about reasonable judgment.
That makes sense from an operational perspective. But from a citizen's viewpoint, does that common sense standard ever feel a bit loose? Like it could be open to abuse if it relies so heavily on an officer's judgment?
That's a very fair question, and it's precisely why probable cause is so often debated and litigated in court. The courts are constantly wrestling with that balance. The need for officers to make rapid decisions in complex, sometimes dangerous situations versus the fundamental right of citizens to be free from arbitrary government intrusion. The reasonable person standard is an attempt to introduce an objective measure. It means an officer's personal belief isn't enough. It must be a belief that a hypothetical, reasonable officer with similar training and experience would also reach based on the same facts.
So it's not just that officer's feeling, but what a typical reasonable officer would think.
Correct. It's an attempt at objectivity. But it's still a challenging area, no doubt. What feels like common sense to one person might feel like an overreach to another. That inherent tension is at the heart of many legal challenges involving probable cause.
Okay, so let's visualize this whole scale. If we imagine a level of proof continuum starting at 0%.
Right. At 0%, you have mere suspicion, just that hunch. A little further along, you find reasonable suspicion, where you have those articulable facts suggesting criminal activity might be happening.
And then a big jump to?
To probable cause. This is a substantial threshold sitting firmly in the middle of the scale. It's the belief that a crime is likely happening or evidence is likely present.
And what's beyond probable cause?
Well, higher standards used in court proceedings. Next up is preponderance of the evidence, which is roughly 51% certainty, the standard typically used in civil cases. Then there's clear and convincing evidence, a higher standard used for certain civil matters or specific legal findings, like determining if a confession was truly voluntary. And finally, at the very top, close to 100%, you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the highest burden required for a criminal conviction.
So probable cause allows for arrest and search, but it's nowhere near the level needed to actually convict someone in court.
Exactly. It's a standard for initiating the legal process or taking immediate action, not for determining guilt. That requires much more proof.
When warrants aren't needed, exigencies and exceptions to the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, so the Fourth Amendment generally says you need a warrant based on probable cause, right, for searches and seizures. But you hinted earlier that there are times when that's not the case. This is where it gets really interesting, isn't it?
It really does. That warrant requirement is the general rule, the default. But the reality on the ground is far more nuanced. There are, in fact, specific, well-defined circumstances where a search or seizure can be considered reasonable and therefore lawful without a warrant.
So what are those circumstances?
Our source material lays it out clearly. A search or seizure is generally considered unreasonable unless one of the following exists. One, you have a valid warrant obtained with probable cause. That's the gold standard. Two, you have valid consent from the person. Three, in very restricted situations involving officer safety, you might act on reasonable suspicion, like the Terry frisk we discussed. Or four, and this covers a lot of ground, you have probable cause plus something extra, either an exigency, a recognized legal exception, or a situation involving a reduced expectation of privacy.
Okay, let's focus on exigency. What does that mean? Exigent circumstances.
Exactly. What's especially critical here is this concept of exigent circumstances. These are essentially emergency situations, situations that reasonably require law enforcement to act immediately without taking the time needed to obtain a warrant. And the key here is reasonableness. The reasonableness for acting immediately will always be judged by the totality of the circumstances present at that specific moment. Courts look at everything together.
So what counts as an emergency or exigency?
There are several key categories. First, preventing serious injury and providing emergency aid. A key Supreme Court case, Brigham City, Utah v. Stewart from 2006, established that exigent circumstances like breaking up a violent fight inside a home permit warrantless entry. The rationale is pretty clear, right? Human life and safety take precedence over the warrant requirement in immediate danger scenarios.
Okay, saving lives or preventing injury makes sense. What else?
Second, preventing the imminent destruction or loss of evidence. This is a very common justification officers might use. For example, if police are knocking on a door and they hear sounds consistent with evidence being destroyed, like toilets flushing repeatedly after they announce themselves, that might create an exigency.
But can police cause that situation?
Good point. The case Kentucky v. King, 2011, clarified this. Officers cannot create the exigency by violating the Fourth Amendment themselves. For instance, they can't make unreasonable demands during a knock and announce, provoke the occupants into destroying evidence, and then claim exigency based on the occupants' reaction to their own illegal conduct. However, if occupants react to a lawful police presence, like a proper knock and announce, in a way that suggests they are destroying evidence, that reaction can create the necessary exigency. It really emphasizes that officers must choose their words and actions carefully during these encounters.
Any other cases on destroying evidence?
Yes. Cup v. Murphy from 1973 is relevant here. It held that a limited search and seizure to prevent the destruction of evidence might be reasonable, even if the individual isn't under formal arrest yet. Imagine a situation where a suspect is actively trying to chew and swallow evidence, or maybe quickly trying to wash blood or gunshot residue off their hands. In those urgent moments, a limited warrantless action might be justified just to preserve that fleeting evidence.
Okay, so protecting people, preserving evidence. What's the third big one?
Third, preventing imminent or immediate escape, which often involves hot pursuit or fresh pursuit. This is crucial for catching fleeing suspects. For felony pursuits, the case Warden v. Hayden, 1967, established that hot or fresh pursuit of a fleeing felon allows officers to enter a place, like a house the suspect ran into, and search for the suspect and any weapons without a warrant. Fresh pursuit here means without unreasonable delay. Basically, they have to be right on the suspect's heels. Importantly, any mere evidence of a crime found in plain view during such a lawful pursuit and entry can also be seized.
What about for less serious crimes, like misdemeanors? Can police chase someone into their house for a misdemeanor without a warrant?
That's a really important and recently clarified area of law. A significant modern update came with Lange v. California in 2021. California had a rule saying that fleeing from any misdemeanor always justified a warrantless entry into a home during hot pursuit. The Supreme Court struck that down. They ruled that such a categorical rule was unconstitutional. Instead, for misdemeanors, the existence of an exigency justifying warrantless home entry must be determined on a case-by-case basis. Just fleeing a misdemeanor isn't automatically enough.
So sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not. How do officers know?
Well, it created some debate. Chief Justice Roberts wrote a strong dissent in Lange, arguing that fleeing itself is inherently an exigency, calling the majority's view potentially absurd and dangerous. Justice Kavanaugh, however, suggested that in practice, the difference might not be huge. He argued that fleeing misdemeanors will almost always also involve another exigency anyway, such as a risk of escape, destruction of evidence, or harm to others. So while fleeing a misdemeanor isn't an automatic green light for entering a home, it often occurs alongside other factors that do create an exigency.
Okay, so bringing this back to practical reality, what does Lange truly change for both citizens and officers on the ground? What's the bottom line?
The bottom line is enhanced scrutiny and the need for clear justification. It means officers must articulate facts and inferences from their training and experience to justify the reasonableness and the need for pursuit and entry, especially in misdemeanor cases now after Lange. They can't just say they ran. They need to explain why that flight, combined with other specific factors observed, created an exigent circumstance requiring immediate warrantless action.
Can you give some examples of what they might articulate?
Sure. An officer might articulate, say, that they saw underage drinkers flee into a house, and their specific concern, based on training, is the imminent risk of those individuals later driving while impaired, DUI. Or they might articulate that the nature of the apparent misdemeanor pursuit, based on their experience, often indicates something more serious is actually going on, or that evidence of that more serious crime could be lost if they don't pursue immediately. Or perhaps simply articulating that we do not know for sure that a suspect is running into their own home, meaning the flight itself creates uncertainty about potential danger to others inside or the suspect's ability to escape further. It highlights the officer's burden now to clearly explain their actions and demonstrate the specific exigency that justified their warrantless entry or pursuit, linking it back explicitly to their training and experience. It's about demonstrable justification, not just a gut feeling.
That makes sense. It requires more explanation. Now, what about something an officer just sees, like evidence sitting out in the open?
That brings us to the plain view doctrine. This doctrine allows officers to seize evidence without a warrant if three specific requirements are met.
Okay, what are the three requirements?
First, the officer must be lawfully present to see or hear or smell whatever it is they perceive. They can't have violated your rights to get to the spot where they made the observation. For example, if they're inside your home unlawfully, anything they happen to see isn't covered by plain view.
Makes sense. Lawfully present. What's second?
Second, it must be immediately apparent to the officer that the item they see is contraband or evidence of a crime. This means they don't need to manipulate it, move it, or conduct any further search to figure out what it is. Its illegal or evidentiary nature must be obvious just from looking at it.
Immediately apparent. Got it. And the third?
Third, the officer must have a lawful right of access to seize the person or item. This is a subtle but important point. For example, an officer might be standing on a public sidewalk and legally see contraband, say, drugs, on a table through a resident's window. They are lawfully present, on the sidewalk, and let's assume it's immediately apparent it's contraband. However, that plain view observation does not automatically authorize an exigentless entry into the home to seize it.
So seeing it isn't enough to go in and grab it?
Not necessarily. They still need that lawful right of access. Seeing it gives them probable cause, which they can then use to get a warrant. Or, if there's some other exception or exigency happening simultaneously, that might give them lawful access. But plain view alone doesn't erase the need to lawfully enter a protected space like a home. The visual evidence can certainly be documented in an affidavit to obtain a warrant, but it doesn't automatically grant them the right to burst through the door.
Okay, that clarifies things. Are there other big exceptions besides exigencies and plain view?
Yes, there are quite a few other situational exceptions to the warrant requirement that peace officers are trained on extensively. These include concepts like weapon frisks and protective sweeps, which are limited searches for safety we touched on with Harry. There are searches incident to arrest, allowing a search of the person and their immediate grabbing area when lawfully arrested. There are specific rules for probable cause and mobile vehicles, which often allow warrantless searches of cars due to their mobility. Also, inventory searches of impounded vehicles or property, which are considered administrative procedures. Community caretaking functions, where officers act not to enforce laws, but to help someone or protect property. And of course, a very common one is consent, where an individual voluntarily agrees to a search. Each of these has its own complex set of rules and case law. For our purposes today, it's mainly important to know they exist as potential justifications for warrantless actions, provided officers meet the specific legal criteria for each one.
The arrest process, warranted and warrantless.
Okay, we've covered searches quite a bit. What about arrests? You mentioned warrants are the gold standard there, too.
Yes, absolutely. The preferred method for making an arrest is always with an arrest warrant. Texas law defines a warrant of arrest very clearly. It's a written order from a magistrate, basically a judge directed to a peace officer or some other person specially named, commanding him to take the body of the person accused of an offense to be dealt with according to law. The key is that it's a formal judicial order based on probable cause, not just an officer's decision on the spot.
And what needs to be in that warrant to make it valid?
The requirements are very specific, laid out in the code. It must be issued in the name of the state of Texas. It must clearly specify the name of the person to be arrested, or if their name is unknown, provide a reasonably definite description so there's no mistake about who is being targeted. It must state that the person is accused of some specific offense against the laws of the state naming that offense. And finally, it must be signed by the magistrate with their office clearly named, like Justice of the Peace, Peach One, etc. These details aren't just, you know, bureaucratic formalities. They are critical constitutional safeguards to ensure the warrant is valid and targets the right person for the right reason.
Doesn't matter when they execute the warrant. Like, can they only arrest you during the day?
No, Texas law is very clear on the time of arrest. It states simply, an arrest may be made on any day or at any time of the day or night. No time restrictions for a valid warrant.
Okay. And once someone is arrested with a warrant, what happens next?
The law dictates how a warrant is executed. The arresting person, without unnecessary delay, must take the arrested individual before a magistrate. While the law says without unnecessary delay, it sets a hard limit. It must happen no later than 48 hours after the arrest.
48 hours? And why do they have to see a magistrate?
It's a crucial step for due process. The purpose is twofold. First, for arraignment warnings, where the accused is formally informed of their rights, like the right to counsel, right to remain silent, etc., and the specific charges against them. And second, for the setting of bail or bond, which determines the conditions, if any, under which they might be released from custody while awaiting trial. The rule also specifies which magistrate they should see, usually the one who issued the warrant if in the same county, or one in the county of arrest if arrested elsewhere, all within that 48-hour window. They can even go to another county if it gets the warnings done faster.
Similar rules for search warrants, I assume, needing specifics.
Very similar, yes. Search warrants also have extremely specific requirements, directly rooted in that Fourth Amendment demand for particularly describing things. Texas law defines a search warrant as a written order issued by a magistrate and directed to a peace officer, commanding him to search for any property or thing and to seize the same. Again, a specific judicial order.
Yeah, they need that affidavit thing you mentioned earlier.
Absolutely crucial. For a search warrant to be issued, a sworn search warrant affidavit must be filed with the magistrate. This affidavit is where the officer lays out all the facts that establish probable cause for the search. It basically tells the story of why the search is needed, detailing the evidence and facts justifying the belief that specific seizable property, like drugs, weapons, stolen goods, will be found in that particular place. The law explicitly says a warrant shall not be issued without sufficient facts presented to a magistrate with probable cause that the facts exist. So the judge isn't just rubber stamping it. They are supposed to be carefully reviewing that detailed sworn factual basis in the affidavit to ensure it truly meets the probable cause standard before authorizing such a significant intrusion into someone's privacy.
Okay, so warrants are ideal. But officers can arrest without one sometimes, right? Yeah. Especially in Texas.
Yes, they can. While warrants are preferred and constitutionally safer, Texas law does grant officers specific powers to arrest without a warrant in certain situations where immediate action is deemed necessary. These are often scenarios where time is of the essence, or the circumstances demand swift intervention based on probable cause observed directly by the officer.
What are some of those key situations in Texas?
Okay, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, Chapter 14, outlines these powers. Here are some of the main ones where an on-duty officer can arrest without a warrant if they have probable cause. First, if they have PC, that a felony has been committed, and there's a credible belief the offender is about to escape, so there's no time to get a warrant. Second, if they have PC, someone is a fugitive from another state charged with a serious crime, punishable by death or over a year in prison. Third, for any offense committed within the officer's direct view or presence.
Presence. Does that just mean seeing it?
Good question. No. Presence is broader than just sight. It includes other senses, like hearing or smelling. For instance, if an officer arrives at a fresh accident scene and sees a suspect still inside or just getting out of the wrecked car, they can reasonably infer the offense, like DWI, occurred in their presence, even if they didn't see the actual crash. But contrast that. If they respond to a call about loud music with multiple complaints, but when they arrive, they don't hear any loud music themselves, they generally lack that presence requirement to make a warrantless arrest based solely on the noise complaints. They didn't perceive it themselves.
Okay. Presence is key. What else?
Let's see. If a felony or a breach of the peace occurs in the view of a magistrate and the magistrate verbally orders the arrest, if someone admits to committing a felony, and there's other probable cause corroborating it, to prevent the immediate consequences of theft, like stopping someone walking out of a store with unpaid items. If someone is found in a suspicious place under circumstances indicating they've committed a felony or breach of peace, and there's a reasonable urgency making arrests necessary. For a non-family violence assault, if there's PC, that further bodily injury to the victim is likely if the suspect isn't arrested. Now, this is a big one. For any family violence offense, if an officer has probable cause that a family violence offense has occurred, the law says they shall arrest. It's a mandatory arrest situation in Texas.
Mandatory for family violence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, it reflects a strong policy focus on protecting victims in those situations. Also, warrantless arrest is allowed for interference with an emergency call if there's PC, and for violations of protective orders if an officer has PC that a violation occurred in their presence, they shall arrest. Another mandatory one.
Okay, quite a list. What about felonies specifically?
Texas law allows officers to pursue and arrest for felonies without warrants if they get satisfactory proof from a credible person showing a felony was committed and the offender is about to escape, so there's literally no time to get a warrant. It emphasizes both credible info and urgency.
Can police from other states chase someone into Texas?
Yes, there's a provision for that too. If officers from another state are in fresh pursuit of a felony suspect, they can continue that pursuit to Texas to make the arrest. Fresh pursuit, again, means without unreasonable delay. It stops felons from simply hopping a state line to evade capture.
And after a warrantless arrest, do they still need to see a judge quickly?
Absolutely. The rule is the same. Regardless of whether the arrest was made with or without a warrant, the arresting officer or whoever has custody must take the offender before a magistrate without unnecessary delay and definitely within that 48-hour maximum. Same purpose, arraignment warnings, setting bail. The location rules are similar to magistrate in the county of arrest or elsewhere if faster for warnings.
Is there anything else about out-of-state fugitives?
Yes, the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act, as adopted in Texas, allows for a warrantless arrest by any peace officer or even a private person in some cases. This is permitted if they have reasonable information that any fugitive is charged with a crime punishable by death or imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year in another state. Once arrested under this provision, the person must be taken before a magistrate with all practicable speed. A formal complaint under oath must then be filed explaining the grounds for the arrest, and the person gets a chance to respond, similar to if they'd been arrested on a warrant. It ensures due process even for those accused of fleeing serious charges from other states.
Safeguarding the accused, the Fifth Amendment.
Okay, we've covered a lot about how you can be searched or arrested. Let's shift our focus now to what happens after an arrest and the fundamental rights you have within the justice system itself. This brings us to the Fifth Amendment, right? Another really foundational piece of the Bill of Rights.
Absolutely. The Fifth Amendment is huge. It reads, "No person shall be held to answer for a capital or other infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. Nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." It's dense, like you said, but incredibly powerful.
So what are the key protections bundled into this one amendment? Can you break it down?
Definitely. There are five core rights or protections packed into the Fifth Amendment. Each one is designed to safeguard individuals from potential government overreach, especially in the criminal justice context, but also regarding property.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, it guarantees grand jury indictments for serious crimes. For capital crimes, punishable by death, or other infamous crimes, which basically means serious felonies, a person cannot be formally charged by the federal government without a presentment or indictment from a grand jury. This acts as a kind of protective screening mechanism, ensuring that a group of citizens believes there's enough evidence to even put someone on trial for a very grave offense.
A check before a major trial. Got it. Second.
Second is double jeopardy protection. This is a really important one. It means you have freedom from being prosecuted a second time for the same crime after you've already been acquitted, found not guilty, or convicted for that specific offense. Once a final judgment has been reached on a specific charge, the government generally can't keep trying you over and over again for that exact same act. Texas law mirrors this protection, adding some specific nuances about when an acquittal bars retrial.
Can't be tried twice for the same thing. Okay, third.
Third is probably the most famous one, the right against self-incrimination. This is often called the right to remain silent. It's your freedom from acknowledging facts which may establish his guilt. This is the basis for the Miranda warnings. You have the right to remain silent. It prevents the government from compelling you to testify against yourself in a criminal case.
The right to remain silent. Crucial. What's number four?
Fourth is the guarantee of due process of law. This is a broad but fundamental concept. It means you must be processed through a system of justice in accordance with established rule, principles, and jurisdiction. It's a guarantee of fundamental fairness, ensuring that legal proceedings are conducted according to established rules and procedures. It protects against arbitrary government action and ensures predictability. And this isn't just about criminal cases. It applies anytime the government might deprive you of life, liberty, or property.
Fundamental fairness. And the fifth one sounds different.
It is a bit different. The fifth protection is just compensation for private property taken for public use. This is often referred to as the power of eminent domain. The amendment guarantees you, well, reasonable reimbursement for any property seized for public use. So if the government needs your private land for a public project like a highway or a park, they can take it, but they must pay you fair market value for it.
Okay, five big protections. How does Texas handle these? Does state law line up?
Yes, very much so. The Texas Constitution and the Code of Criminal Procedure mirror and often provide specific details for these fundamental federal rights. Various articles in the Texas Constitution, like Article 1, Section 10, 13, 14, 17, 19, and statutes, like CCP 1.04, reiterate these protections rights of the accused. Due course of law, protection against double jeopardy, protection against uncompensated taking of property.
Now, you mentioned the grand jury requirement for serious federal crimes. How does Texas handle charging people, especially for felonies?
Right, this connects directly. Texas uses three primary charging instruments to formally bring charges against someone. First, there's the complaint. This is defined as an affidavit made before the magistrate or district county attorney if it charges the commission of an offense. It has specific requirements. Needs the accused's name or description, states the offense, affirms the affiant's belief it happened, gives time and place, and must be signed by the affiant. It's often used for initiating charges, especially misdemeanors, or as the basis for an arrest warrant affidavit.
Okay, a complaint is an affidavit. What else?
Second, there's the information. This is defined as a written statement filed and presented for the state by the district county attorney charging the defendant with an offense, end quote. Oh, But crucially, the law says no info shall be presented until an affidavit, a complaint has been made by some credible person charging the defendant with an offense. The affidavit shall be filed with the information. Yeah. So an information is the formal charge by the prosecutor, but it must be supported by a sworn complaint. It's typically used for prosecuting misdemeanors in county court.
Complaint, information. What's the third?
The third is the indictment. This is defined as a written statement of a grand jury accusing a person of some act or omission, which by law is declared to be an offense. And this is particularly important because in Texas, an indictment by a grand jury is required to prosecute felonies in district court, unless waived, which we'll get to. This directly reflects and reinforces the Fifth Amendment's grand jury requirement for serious crimes at the state level, adding that extra layer of citizen scrutiny before serious felony charges can proceed to trial.
So felony charges in Texas generally need a grand jury indictment.
That's the standard rule, yes. And all of these charging instruments, complaint, information, indictment, they ultimately connect back to that concept of the probable cause affidavit. That affidavit, usually sworn by a law enforcement officer, is the document detailing the specific facts and circumstances that provide the probable cause needed to justify an arrest or search in the first place. It forms the factual underpinning for initiating the whole legal process and supports the formal charges laid out in these instruments.
Fair trial rights, the Sixth Amendment.
Okay, so the Fifth Amendment gives us these broad protections like due process and the right to remain silent. But the Sixth Amendment seems more focused on the trial itself.
Exactly. While the Fifth provides overarching safeguards, the Sixth Amendment zeroes in specifically on all criminal prosecutions. It details the nuts and bolts of what a fair trial actually looks like. Think of these as the rights you can literally see and touch, or at least experience directly, if you ever find yourself in a courtroom facing criminal charges.
What does it say?
The court text reads, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense."
Okay, quite a few rights packed in there, too. Can we break those down? Looks like six main ones.
Yes. It lays out six fundamental rights for the accused with remarkable clarity. First, the right to a speedy and public trial. This means you're entitled to a formal trial free from unreasonable delay. Justice delayed is justice denied, right? And the trial must be open to public view. This transparency is a safeguard against secret proceedings. Texas law, CCP 1.24, also explicitly guarantees a public trial.
Speedy and public. Makes sense. Second.
Second, the right to an impartial jury. This guarantees your case will be heard by an unbiased jury, people from the community who can decide the facts fairly without prejudice for or against you.
Unbiased jury.
Third, the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. You have the right to knowledge of the basis and type of accusation against him. This goes hand in hand with those charging instruments we just discussed. You can't prepare a defense effectively if you don't know precisely what crime the government alleges you committed. Texas CCP 1.05 echoes this right to know the accusation.
Okay, know the charges. Fourth,
the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. This is huge. It generally means you have the right to cross-examine witnesses who are testifying against you in court. You get to challenge their testimony, question their memory, expose potential bias. It's a powerful tool for testing the truthfulness and reliability of the evidence presented by the prosecution. Texas CCP 1.25 affirms this right, though it notes exceptions for things like depositions under specific circumstances.
Confrontation, cross-examination. Fifth.
Fifth, the right to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in your favor. This means you can use the power of the court through subpoenas to obtain witnesses by requiring their presence in court. If someone has information that could help your defense, you can compel them to come to court and testify on your behalf.
So you can force people to testify for you?
If their testimony is relevant and necessary, yes. The court can compel their attendance. And sixth, finally, the right to have the assistance of counsel for your defense. This guarantees the advice and representation of an attorney in court. This is often seen as one of the most critical rights, as navigating the complexities of the criminal justice system without professional legal guidance would be nearly impossible for most people to do effectively.
That right to counsel seems incredibly important. How does Texas law handle that, especially for people who can't afford a lawyer?
It is incredibly important, and Texas law elaborates on it significantly. The Code of Criminal Procedure, CCP 1.051, specifically addresses the right to representation by counsel. It applies in adversarial judicial proceedings where confinement, jail, or prison time is a possible punishment. And if you cannot afford an attorney, the law provides for indigent appointments. The court must appoint a lawyer for you in cases with potential confinement, or even in other cases when the court concludes that the interests of justice require representation. This ensures that poverty doesn't become a barrier to having legal representation when facing serious charges.
So the court appoints one if you can't pay. Can you choose not to have a lawyer?
You can, but it's a significant decision. The law requires that if you choose to waive your right to counsel and represent yourself, any attorney waiver notices must be signed.
Right.
This creates a formal record showing you were informed of your right to an attorney and made a knowing, voluntary decision to give up that right. It's a safeguard to ensure you understand the implications.
Okay. Now, what about the right to a jury? Can you waive that? Like, have a judge decide instead?
That's another important question about waivers. Yes, you can waive a jury trial in many cases in Texas, but there are significant limitations and strict procedures. While CCP 1.12 says broadly that a person may waive any right guaranteed to them in court, CCP 1.13 lays out specific rules for waiving a jury trial.
What are the big rules?
First and foremost, a huge exception. You cannot waive a jury trial in capital felony cases where the state is seeking the death penalty. In those ultimate stakes cases, a jury trial is absolutely mandatory, no exception.
Okay, no waiver in death penalty cases. What about other cases?
For other cases, if you want to waive your right to a jury and have a judge decide guilt or innocence, a bench trial, several conditions must be met. You have to enter a plea first, usually guilty or no contest, though sometimes not guilty. The waiver must be made in person by you, the defendant. It has to be done in open court on the record. And critically, both the judge, the court, and the prosecutor, the state attorney, must approve the waiver. The state attorney actually has to sign the waiver document before your plea request is even entered.
So the prosecutor has to agree to let you waive the jury?
Yes. The state has an interest in jury trials, too, so they have to consent. Now, for capital felony cases where the death penalty is not being sought, the accused can waive the jury, but again, only if the state attorney consents in writing in open court. Also, generally, you can waive a jury trial without having an attorney yourself unless it's a felony case. If it's a felony, the court must ensure you have counsel appointed or have properly waived counsel before you can waive the jury to make sure you understand the rights you're giving up.
So lots of checks and balances on waiving a jury. Can other rights be waived?
Yes. CCP 1.14 says defendants may waive many rights, again, with that major exception for jury waivers and death penalty capital cases. For example, CCP 1.141 allows for the waiver of indictment for non-capital felony. If you have legal counsel, you can agree, in open court or in writing, to be charged by an information instead of waiting for a grand jury indictment for a non-capital felony. This can sometimes speed up the process if you intend to plead guilty anyway.
What if you plead guilty? Does the state still have to prove the case?
That's a really interesting point addressed in CCP 1.15 regarding the jury in felony cases. It says, unless waived properly, no felony conviction can happen without a jury verdict. But it adds a crucial protection. You cannot convict without evidence to support guilt, even if you plead guilty or no contest. This means the state must still introduce some evidence into the record that supports the finding of guilt. They can't just rely solely on your plea. Now, the defendant can waive this requirement for evidence in writing, but the court has to approve that waiver, too. This rule prevents convictions based purely on a plea without any underlying factual basis being presented to the court, which acts as a safeguard.
So even with a guilty plea, there needs to be some evidence presented unless you specifically waive that.
Correct. It ensures there's a factual foundation for the conviction. Other rights tied to the Sixth in Texas law that are worth mentioning again are the public trial, CCP 1.24, ensuring transparency, and the right to be confronted by witnesses, CCP 1.25, allowing cross-examination, with that note about exceptions for depositions. It's a detailed framework for fairness.
Civil justice, the Seventh Amendment.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time on criminal procedure rights with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. For our last amendment in this deep dive, we're shifting gears completely, right, to civil disputes.
Exactly. We move out of the criminal realm entirely and into the world of civil lawsuits disputes between private parties, often over money or property. This is where the Seventh Amendment comes in. It's sometimes overlooked compared to the others, but it's vital for everyday legal conflicts.
What does the Seventh Amendment guarantee?
It reads, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Okay, suits at common law. Trial by jury shall be preserved. What does that mean practically?
What's fascinating here is the specific protection of jury trials in civil cases filed in federal court. In many types of civil suits, think contract disputes, personal injury claims like car accidents, property disagreements, if the case is the type that would have been heard by a jury back when the amendment was written, suits of common law, and involves more than a nominal amount, the $20 is historical, the principle applies to substantial disputes, you are entitled to have a jury decide the facts.
So you can get a jury even if you're not facing criminal charges?
In federal court, for those types of cases, yes. And furthermore, the amendment states that, quote, no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined than according to the rules of common law. This means that if a jury makes a factual finding in a federal civil case, that finding is generally given great deference on appeal. Appeal courts can review legal errors, but they can't easily second-guess the jury's decision on the facts themselves, unless specific common law rules for overturning a verdict are met. It ensures a degree of finality and respect for the jury's role as the fact finder, even in non-criminal matters. Common law here refers to those established legal principles derived from judicial decisions over time, providing a consistent framework.
So it protects the jury's power in civil cases, too.
Precisely. It ensures fairness and consistency, providing a crucial check and balance in the broader legal system, not just the criminal one.
So, wow. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground in this deep dive. What does this all mean for you, our listener? We went from the core protections of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures, through those nuanced levels of suspicion, mere suspicion, reasonable suspicion, probable cause that dictate police action, then into the critical rights guaranteed by the Fifth and Sixth Amendments for anyone accused of a crime, things like grand juries, double jeopardy, the right to remain silent, due process, speedy trials, impartial juries, and the right to counsel. And we even touched on the Seventh Amendment's crucial role in preserving jury trials for civil disputes.
Yeah, it's a lot, but hopefully presented in a way that makes sense.
Absolutely. Our goal was really to make these complex, sometimes intimidating legal concepts understandable and hopefully actionable for you. These aren't just abstract ideas floating around in law books. They are living, breathing, fundamental safeguards that shape our daily lives and our interactions with the legal system. Understanding them is, I think you're right, and frankly, kind of a civic superpower in navigating the world, wouldn't you say?
I would. And what this deep dive reveals, especially looking through the lens of that law enforcement training material, is that understanding these boundaries isn't just abstract. It's about equipping yourself with the essential user manual, as you called it, for interacting with authority. The intricate balance between individual rights and governmental power, defined by these amendments and constantly interpreted by courts, it's always evolving, isn't it? This dynamic between law enforcement's powers and the citizens' protections is a living dialogue, shaped by societal changes and new challenges.
That's a great way to put it, a living dialogue.
Which raises, I think, an important final question for you to consider. Given the detailed instructions and specific powers outlined for law enforcement in their own training, what further responsibilities do you believe citizens might have in understanding and upholding these constitutional principles in their own communities? How can a more informed citizenry contribute to a legal system that is both effective in maintaining order and just in protecting rights? This exploration truly shows that knowledge is power, especially when it comes to your fundamental rights.